Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. This is the first Reaction Podcast in a while, and I'm delighted that it's back. This podcast is for Reaction subscribers. My guest today, I'm delighted to welcome my friend and colleague, Danny Finkelstein, and we're about to discuss his extraordinary new book. Danny, obvious first question, where did this come from? I mean, these must have been the stories of your childhood. When did you decide it had to be a book?
Well, look, I've fun enough, always known that one day I would write this story. And that I knew despite the fact that I wasn't much of a writer when I was younger, or much of a reader even, until I was in my late teens. But I have a distinct memory of being in my grandmother's house and thinking about how I would start an account of their story. And so I've known for almost ever, really, almost as long as I've known the story or known what books were, that one day I'd write this. The one question was, when would it be? And that required two things. It required me to have enough time to spend on it, because I've got so many things to do, and I knew this would take quite a lot of time to work on. And secondly, it would require a sort of political moment to make it something that I had to do, to compel me to sit down and work on it. And we got both of those things, because first of all, there was Donald Trump, and then there was COVID, and that provided both the political motivation to do it, my concern that we are flirting with the dangers of populism and of extremist ideology. And the other thing that happened was COVID, and it meant that all the meetings that I have, suddenly you didn't have to travel to them, mm-hmm. and you sometimes didn't have to have them because you were on Zoom. And so much as I value, for example, helping a PhD student who was inquiring into on the subject of idiots who lost general elections and thought I might be a good interviewee, I was quite happy to have that time back to spend on my own work.
Yeah. So the book starts with a heartwarming picture of family life in Hendon, where your parents landed after this extraordinary story. What comes across is their incredible sense of humour, warmth and humanity. You pose a really good question. How, after this story, which we're about to get into, how did they end up so normal?
It is a good, I mean, it is an interesting question, and even though obviously now thought about it a lot and written about it, I'm not sure I've come up with an entirely satisfactory answer. I think it's a little bit about their personalities, but it was also, they made a deliberate attempt not to be victims and to look to the future. There are two things about my dad, I think, that show that. One is that despite the fact that he's had the chance, during the later years of his life, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, to go back to Ukraine and visit the house that's in the place that we now know as Lviv, but he knew as Lvov, the Polish town that became a Ukrainian town. He didn't do that. And he always used to say to me, I think it's better that I'm here and the property's there than the other way around. And so I think that was one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it was that my father, it turns out, while he told me about a lot of things that happened to him, there were bits of his story, as I wrote about it, I realised he'd never really spoken about. And I think he just decided he was going to draw a line under it. He would tell me the stories, he would answer my questions, but he wasn't going to live in his experiences, and my mum felt the same.
And her phrase comes up several times in the book is, it's not a competition.
Yeah, so she asked often, there were a couple of reasons for that phrase. One was that we would sometimes go to Holocaust survivor events and people would trade their experiences, all of them horrendous. And there would sometimes be what my mother regarded as an absolutely ludicrous attempt to suggest that one person's experience might have been worse than somebody else's. And she found that, frankly, a bit obscene, really. But there was also this other question, which was my father's experience and my mother's. My father as a victim of Stalin, my mother as a victim of Hitler. How did they compare? And my mother was always keen to say that you start down that road, it's sort of an empty question, really, and you shouldn't. So she had that phrase, it's not a competition. And I did, at one point, think of calling the book that. The book's title began, or at least, you know, actually began as Love and Murder, but eventually it became It's Not a Competition, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad. And I looked at it and talked to my agent about it, actually, who didn't like It's Not a Competition. And suddenly it was obvious that the subtitle, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, was the title.
Yeah. So tell us where it begins. Tell us about the two families before these awful experiences hit them. Life in two different parts of Europe. Describe it for us, please.
Okay, yes. Well, I'll start with my mother. My mother was the daughter of one of the leaders of Germany's Jews in the 1920s, a man called Alfred Wiener. In the 1920s, Alfred had come back after the First World War, realised very early on that anti-Semitism was going to turn violent, had, as early as 1919, written a tract warning of anti-Semitic forces and the fact that that our ancestors will write of bloodshed. Yeah. And bestial deeds. This is what he said in 1919, unless we do something. And of course, that is exactly what did then happen. He went to work for an organization called the Zentralverein. It was the big Jewish communal organization, rose to become general secretary, spent all his time going around the country addressing big meetings, often broken up by Nazi gangs, addressing libels against the Jewish people, giving lectures, helping with an effort to sue the Nazis. They ended up sending Julius Streicher to jail, the man who's ultimately hanged after Nuremberg. Mm. We sort of follow Alfred's life in the book, and his marriage to an economist, somebody with a PhD, even though she was a woman in Germany in the 1920s, Greta Wiener. My mother's born in 1933. She's born just a few months after Alfred has been called in by Goering, and it becomes obvious that Goering is aware of a piece of Alfred's work that he's kept secret, which is that he's been collecting the Nazi propaganda. He's been collecting Nazi, pieces of information like what did they all look like? What uniforms did they wear? What ranks did they have? So years later, when Mengele was in South America and there was a question about finding him, Alfred was the only person who had a picture of him.
Because he's built this library,
Library. But Goering discovers this and he tells him he has to destroy it. And what happens is they do have to do that. He destroys it, begins it again in Holland, and he allows, and he gets out of Germany. So my mother is born in Germany, but in 1934, when she's less than a year old, she begins a life in Amsterdam. So that's my mother's story, and it proceeds from there. I'm sure we'll discuss more of it. My father is the son of a very wealthy man. Some people have said to me, oh, he was well off, your grandfather. Well, that understates it. He was a rich man. Yes. He had the nickname the Iron King, I discovered.
Yeah, it's clear he'd built an extraordinary business.
Extraordinary business. And he was a big Jewish communal leader, not a religious Jew. Like my grandfather, by the way, not a Zionist. Mm. Neither of them were Zionists. Like my other grandfather, rather. Neither of them were Zionists. Ludwig, my father, was their only son. The idea was, you know, him and Lusha, Dolu and Lusha, my grandparents, they'd have this wonderful son, and eventually he would take over the business, and the life that had been for the Finkelsteins hundreds of years in Lvov would continue. And then the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is very quickly followed by the invasion of Poland. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is the instigator for everything that happens to my parents. It allows the Russians, or the Soviets, and the Germans to invade Poland, and it frees up Hitler to invade the low countries as well. So that is the beginning of their story and the destruction of everything that my grandfather had built.
Just on the Zionist point, as you say, both families skeptical on the Zionist movement and really have a picture of a different kind of Europe, don't they?
It's a very, very interesting thought. The other day I was reading an article about Martin Luther King, with whom I'm totally fascinated, and Malcolm X. And I realised that though it's an analogy as opposed to a direct comparison, the relationship between my grandfather and the Zionists was a bit like the relationship between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Martin Luther King believed that African Americans were not just African but Americans, and his job was to emancipate them so they could live as African Americans, and it's his great claim that he succeeded so far in doing so. Malcolm X believed that African Americans were African but would never be true Americans. This is a very similar argument, yes, the one my grandfather had. My grandfather was believed very strongly that German Jews were German and Jewish, that those things belonged together, that Jews could help shape German culture. And the Zionists said, no, we're Jews, and your idea that you could live here in peace is an illusion. Imagine the disaster mentally and politically for my grandfather when the Nazis contradict everything that he's been arguing with the Zionists over. My grandfather wrote a book, actually. Alfred wrote a book about Palestine. He was an Arabist, and he worried about lots of things, about the economic future of a potential state, about the impact it would have on German Jews, but also about whether or not it was possible to live in peace in that area. And you have to look at it and think, well, the Zionists were saying to him, we've got to get out or they'll kill us. And my grandfather was saying, we can't go there, it won't work, because you'll never have peace. And the great tragedy for Jews is they're both right.
Well, this is precisely the point I was going to make, is that you can see the glory in the Martin Luther King analysis, but the Zionists with their realism are also vindicated ultimately, aren't they?
They're vindicated in certain respects. So my grandfather, for example, believed that Tel Aviv would probably not be economically successful, and it's been gigantically economically successful.
Yep.
He did think the kibbutz movement was a socialist utopian project that wouldn't work, and I think he was essentially right about that. But most importantly, he argued there are too many Jews in Europe. We can't all fit in that in Palestine. And if we do, we'd never have peace with the people who live there already. And obviously, the question of there being too many Jews in Europe, Hitler made an adjustment to that, as it were. But the question of whether they can live in peace, well, clearly, even there, people don't want the Jews to live among them in any large number. So the tragedy for Jewish people is that none of the solutions, communism, integrationism, or Zionism, that were being posited in the 1920s, are yet long-term solutions. And they go in and out. So at the moment, obviously, people are safe in some places in Western Europe. For many years, people have said Jews will be safe in the United States. And there's been even that theory, you know, why did you have to create the State of Israel? Everyone could have lived, you know, the Americans, if they'd been willing to, could have taken, and everyone could have lived in New York. And now you look at that United States and wonder, well, how safe would that have been?
Mm-hmm. Good point. Let's go back to the family stories. And you describe it, tell the story beautifully. But it is a really chilling story, and you get this sense of rising tension, the knot tightening, both families getting closer and closer to danger. And people are obviously going to read the book. Some people who have listened to this podcast will have had will have read the book already. But just describe for us that process. Both families going from affluence, prosperity, optimism in certain senses about their economic future, into something that's unimaginable within the space of a decade.
I mean, it's a disaster brought about by conspiracist thinking and ideology, and the idea that elites were somehow strangling, either the proletariat or Germany, and these elites consisted of Jews and capitalists. And the way I put it is, The Nazis arrested all the Jews, some of whom were shopkeepers, and the Soviets arrested all the shopkeepers, some of whom were Jews. And basically, my parents are subject of similar sorts of movements, even though they hated each other. Yeah. You know, they were similar sorts of movements. So in my in the case of my mother, she's living in Holland, and you have to imagine the circumstances is quite similar to Anne Frank, which, and they knew the Frank family. The reason is that my mother, though I always thought of her when I was growing up as Dutch, is in fact, as I've already explained, really German.
Yeah.
She's got German parents who, you know, who sort of were highly intellectual. The house was covered in books. My grandfather and my grandmother, you know, my aunt's autograph book from when she's a 10-year-old child, my grandmother, the inscription is a quote from Goethe, you know, that you give you an idea of the sort of family they were. They lived actually quite a peaceful, happy life until thinking that Holland would remain neutral. My grandfather goes to London in order to carry on his work because he worried the Dutch would interrupt his work, fearing that his own collection of Nazi material would undermine their neutrality. So he goes to London, but he doesn't bring the rest of the family, and they're then trapped in Holland. My father on my other side, and my grandfather on the other side, they are perfectly living a happy and contented childhood. My father was born in 1929, until the invasion that takes place immediately after the Ribbentrop, or very shortly after the Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, and the results of it are fairly immediate. Within a few months, Lvov has become part of Soviet Ukraine. They've lost the business which they had built. They've moved out. They built a beautiful house on a hill, a sort of modernist, I've been inside it, modernist Art Deco home, still absolutely contemporary even now. And they're made to leave that.
There's no possibility at any point of restitution, or that isn't how the system works, is it?
I mean, at the time, you mean?
I mean, shortly after the war. I mean, course, then Cold War happens.
No,
and
so
by
one of the things that's interesting.
Late.
So we did get some restitution for German property from my mother's side, and interestingly enough, some restitution because of having been Poles from the Germans to my grandmother in the 1960s, but never from the Soviets. Yeah. There were a number of reasons for that. The biggest one of which is they annexed Soviet Ukraine,
so they make them stateless.
They make them Ukrainian, right? My father, even in his last years of his life, always said, you know, I never stopped being a Polish citizen. They just sort of cancelled it. They made the Soviet Ukraine Soviet. They made Lvov Ukrainian, and they made Ukraine part of the Soviet Union. And then they simply nationalised the property. And one of the reasons we can't get compensation for it even now, and I went to visit this house. There's a man who owns a restaurant who lives in it. He's living in my dad's house, right, which was just taken from them, and now someone else is living in there. But you could not reverse that without pulling the sort of plug on the whole of system of property rights in the Ukraine. So that's not never going to be possible, because the thing that's very interesting, however quixotic and capricious and cruel the things that were done to my parents, they were almost always done under some form of made up rule or law. Sometimes the justice, there's a moment in the book where my grandfather is sentenced to 8 years as an antisocial element under the Ukrainian criminal code. But it was possible, my son helped me with some bits of fact checking, and it was possible for Sam to check the exact clause of the reason he had to do that was because my father, in his evidence, in his witness statement, had muddled up whether it was 413 or 1413. Yeah. Anyway, we checked it. You can still check it. In other words, these things were done under laws that existed. Now, in the Soviet case, those laws were never overturned. In the Nazi case, of course, they were. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference.
It's very effective in the book. The rules under which he's initially arrested, and then the family is transported. Yes. You run them all in full,
yeah.
And it's chilling because it effectively it covers everything.
So what there is a list. It actually refers, in fact, to Lithuania, but historians believe it applied right across the countries that they took over. There is a list of all the people that they regard as under suspicion that they're going to arrest once they take power in Lithuania and the part of Poland they took over. And this includes everybody who's like a head teacher, shop owner, somebody who's been in the army, of course, every kind of socialist, which is, you know, because who would be more likely to breach a socialist doctrine than another socialist of not quite the same doctrine. And then there was also people who spoke Esperanto, because they were likely to have international connections.
Stamp collectors,
because they had international connections. So anybody who had the slightest bit of civic power. Well, my grandfather was a very rich person. He was on the city council. He'd been a sort of representative of Jews on the city council. It was obvious that he would get arrested, and he was arrested, and his interrogators are clearly trying to frame a charge of advancing the interests of capitalist Poland, which he definitely did. Strengthening the might of capitalist Poland, which is what he did. And he was undoubtedly guilty of that. But ultimately, what he is found guilty of is being an antisocial element. And the interesting thing about that is he wasn't called to any kind of tribunal. He was just interviewed for a long time and then taken and given a sentence and disappears into the gulag.
Yep. So on your mother's side, they end up in Westerbork.
Yes. So
how on earth did they how did they survive?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, Westerbork was the camp in which the Germans concentrated all the Jews. That they took this camp over, by the way, from the Dutch
who built it with Jewish money,
because originally it was a place for refugees who'd got into Holland that they wanted to keep out. They agreed they could stay only if the Jews paid for them, and they paid for a camp to put them in. And that was what Westerbork was. Well, the Nazis take over Westerbork, and they begin to gather together all the Jews. And every Tuesday leaves a transport, sometimes two, that goes to gas chambers. There are two sets. One is well-known, Auschwitz, where some people live because they are sentenced to be slave labourers, and some people die immediately. And then Sobibor, where for several months people were sent, and in Sobibor, the average lifespan was 3 hours. Nobody survived Sobibor. It's why people hardly know of it, because everyone dies. Everybody goes there except this. If you had an exemption, you might not go. And so at the beginning, when people go to Westerbork, they're desperately trying to say what the exemption might be. And everyone knows that Himmler is now trying to take Jews hostage. He's trying to find Jews that have some exchange value, that you could exchange for money, that you could exchange for Germans who lived in Allied occupied countries, or that you might be able to exchange for military equipment. He thinks he's going to keep them. He, in fact, then decides to build a camp for these people called Belsen. And if you could persuade the people who are running the Westerbork camp that you had some exchange value, you might not be sent on the Tuesday transport. And while my great aunt, my mother's first cousin Fritz, my great aunt Trudy, my great uncle Jan are all on one of the Tuesday transports within 3 weeks of arriving in Westerbork, that doesn't happen to my mother, her sisters, and my grandmother. They stay in Westerbork for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months they are transferred to Belsen, because they had a piece of paper that suggested they might be they might be eligible for an exchange to Palestine. A rather faked up document. It's all a bit complicated, but the most important thing is that wasn't the document that really saved them. The document that really saved them is they were citizens of Paraguay. An entirely fake designation, but one that ultimately ends up saving their life.
And on your on the other side of the family, the story is the gulag.
Yes. There are two things. So my grandfather has disappeared. He's arrested. They come in one night and arrest him. And they say to my grandmother, come back in 4 days and we'll tell you where we've taken your husband. And 3 days after that, they arrest all the families. And so what people don't probably know is hundreds of thousands of Poles were arrested and sent to work in state collective farms in the Soviet interior. In my grandmother's case and my father's case, on the on the Kazakhstan-Siberia border. And the idea is twofold. One is obviously a further way of destroying any chance of political opposition. My father is 10, but he wasn't always going to be 10.
Yep.
And then second, it's a sort of form of Soviet levelling up, right? They are going to send them to places which don't have any population and can't make an income, and they're going to get those people to work the land, even though, and if they starve to death, that's probably a bonus, because then they won't be there anymore to be a nuisance. This is what happens to my father and my grandmother, meanwhile not knowing at all what's happened to Dolu, my grandfather. And probably if you had to ask me for the most powerful and surprising section of the book, I think most people will find it the account of what happens to my father at this point. My father gave an amazingly detailed, he had a very, very good memory, my dad, and he gave an amazingly detailed account of it. It was a little bit out of order sometimes when I, it was slightly jumbled, but once I sort of straightened it into a line, I realized it was an extraordinary account of what he'd of what you'd experienced. There is a literature on this which you can discover, but it's generally powerful but not distinguished, and I thought there was a chance to provide an account that people didn't know. And lots of people have told me,
yes,
well, we didn't really know what Belsen was. Actually, they didn't realize it was an exchange camp. They knew nothing about the Paraguayan passports. So my mother's story is, as it were, an extraordinary story of something that you do know about, the Holocaust. My grandfather and my father's, on the other side, my father's story, that is an extraordinary story that you probably don't know.
I wanted to ask you about the question of equivalence, because with your mother's slogan in mind, it's not a competition, notwithstanding that. Do you see the regimes and their policies as directly equivalent? Because there's a long debate about this, isn't there, about the unique nature of the Holocaust as a crime?
Yes, and that's a slightly different thing. So you've asked me, in fact, what sounds like one question, but it's in fact two questions. Do I regard the regimes as equivalent, and do I regard the crimes as equivalent? Let's deal with the crimes first. Both the experiences of my mother and my father were very similar to each other. And indeed, my mother often pointed out that on one occasion she's taken on a cattle truck from Amsterdam to Westerbork. It was stifling hot. People did die of it. And it was appalling experience. But it lasted several hours. My father is transported on a train, slightly better weather conditions, but it took 3 weeks. And my mother would often make that point. But their experiences were similar. Basically, both these regimes had a good chance to starve them to death. They had a good attempt to starve them to death, and it was appalling what happened to either of them. But there was an element to the Nazi crime that the Soviet crime does lack, and it is a particularly shocking element, which is unique, and that is the sort of factory death element of it, which my it's true that the death of my family friend, the Schrager, Ignazi Schrager, shot by the Soviets in Katyn, 22,000 officers, shot without trial on spurious grounds, which the Soviets then lied about for many years, is a crime of a similar nature. However, there is something completely shocking and distinct about the Holocaust. It's why the Holocaust has and the gas chambers. It's why the Holocaust has got that particular reputation. But then you asked about whether the regimes were equivalent, and there I think it's easier. I think they were very similar regimes. You know, they're obviously not the same people, so I don't know what equivalent means. But yes, in morally and in terms of political structure, my view is they both were driven by conspiracy theory, which was that the freedom of mankind and the freedom and prosperity of mankind was being denied by a conspiratorial elite. They had somewhat different ideas, though in people terms, remarkably similar ideas of who those might be, And they set about to eliminate those people in order to gain their utopia. And that makes them very similar. They also were personally, you know, combined personal cruelty, arbitrary murder, arbitrary arrest, the willingness of senior officials to simply sign documents with which involved tens of thousands or millions of people being displaced or killed, right? So they had that in common with each other, and they were also secretive and liars. You know, Stalin got away with his lie about Katyn picking up the phone and pretending that these officers were somehow lost in Nazi Germany, when he knew very well that he'd signed the order himself to shoot them. A very important point. Him and Beria and Molotov all signed the order that led those officers to be killed. And the Nazis, you know, despite their shock, their mock horror at discovering the Katyn murderers, talked all the time about evacuating to the east, when they full well knew that what they were evacuating my great aunt to was murder.
There's a historical complication in the case of Britain, though, isn't there? Because it's clouded by the fact that the Soviet Union becomes Britain's ally and ends up on the winning side. So less is known about those crimes until later. And large parts of British public opinion during the war, because of Stalingrad and Russian resistance, is very pro-Soviet.
Yeah,
and right through until the 1960s and
1970s. Look, you can still see it now. People who go on about the Soviet sacrifice in the war, which they suffered by accident because Hitler invaded them, something that Stalin didn't think would happen. That wasn't Stalin's plan at all, even though you'd have to be... It is astonishing, you know, remarkably blind not to see that Hitler was quite likely to do that after signing it. But I think it's hopefully a sort of redresses some of that bias that still exists. We had the anniversary of the Nuremberg trials, and one of the things, the points I make, is that all of the crimes for which the Nuremberg defendants were found guilty. And I had an amazing moment, Ian, right at the beginning of doing the book. The first folder I opened was something that my step grandmother had given me, a folder of obituaries of Alfred, of her husband. And I opened this, and the first document that comes out was the my grandfather's personal copy of the indictment of the Nuremberg conspirators, because he'd been quite involved in the Nuremberg trials, which is obviously an amazing document to hold in your hands. And I read it as one of the first things I did, and I realised the Soviets had been guilty of all of those crimes. Yet they were obviously on the prosecution side. They even attempt to prosecute the Nazis for Katyn, a crime that they'd committed themselves, and everybody involved knew that they'd committed. So it was, you know, pretty extraordinary, really. But I am trying to address that a little bit with this with this book. I hasten to add, what I try to do here is to tell a story and to let readers make up their own mind. For me, that is certainly one of the things that comes out of it, but I hope people won't feel lectured to. I tried very hard to cut out any attempts to write long political essays about my opinion.
Well, I was going to ask, what was your overriding emotion when you're writing the book? I mean, there must have been points where you were furious at what you were uncovering. And there's obviously your journalistic interest. You're on a detective trail at various points, and you're getting more and more information. It's interesting, but it's about your own family. Did you sometimes feel dejected by
there
it?
There were all sorts of emotions. So one, undoubtedly, the studying what happened to Trudy, Jan and Fritz, to my great aunts, uncle and cousin in Sobibor, required me to read about Sobibor to understand the process. I felt I had to share that with the reader. I tried to take everyone into every room the characters go in and to tell the history of that period through things that actually happened directly to my family. And it is pretty much extraordinary. You know, my father and my grandmother and my grandfather end up as neighbours of Nikita Khrushchev. My mother knew Anne Frank. My grandfather has a personal encounter with Goering. Ignacy Schrager is personally killed in the Katyn massacre. So I felt that's one of the books I was trying to write is here's a journey through all these great events, and my family was actually there. So I was trying to do that, and certainly when I did the Sobibor chapter or section, actually it's not a whole chapter but a section, that was pretty depressing. I hadn't really maybe hadn't come fully to terms with how awful that had been, and so that was a depressing thing. There were, I admit this, moments of elation. I'd always wondered how my mother had obtained the passports that ultimately they are able to use to attain their freedom. They're part of a swap. One of the only 136 people out of millions of people who are killed, obviously, and 136 people are involved in a swap from Belsen. And my mother and her siblings and her mother are among them because of these false Paraguayan passports. But how did they obtain them? I knew how they'd been created, but not how they were obtained. And quite late on in my research, I discover who... I knew that they'd received it from a woman called Camilla Arnault, and I discover how she links to the story through because she had a police file. She helped my grandfather during the war. He was still making a collection of material about the Nazis. He was living in the United States. She was in Switzerland. And because of this weird thing, which was she was collecting Nazi newspapers, the Swiss police interview her, and there's the Swiss police file. And in the Swiss police file, I was able to find a crucial piece of information. I won't spoil it. That explains where the passports came from. That was elation. It was wonderful to do it. There are moments when I'm angry. Probably I was a little bit when I reached the end of the book and I looked back on what had happened to the family. And then there was real satisfaction to have finally completed a task I suppose I've been thinking about for, you know, more than 50 years, and to do tribute to, you know, particularly to my grandfather, my mother's father, Alfred Wiener, because the Wiener Library exists in London, and he was a celebrated man. When he dies, there's obituaries in every newspaper. Great honour is done to him. But to the end, and my grandmother, Lucia, my father's mother, she survived until she was 80 and or 79, and was much loved by us, and knew that we loved her, For me, it was a great satisfaction, though, to be able to do justice to Dolu, my father's father, and to Greta, my mother's mother, for reasons that will become obvious when you read it. I think the book is also a book about two strong women, about Lucia, my father's mother, and about Greta, my mother's mother. It was powerful to feel I'd learnt about their lives and was able to tell stories which amount to heroism in many parts of the book, I think.
And it's a story, as you mentioned there, of liberation. So it has a redemptive quality.
Yeah, it's not. It's in places, and I'll acknowledge this. It's hard because of what happens to various individuals, and that's inevitable because of the subject. And the experiences were hard, but I hope. And this is what most people have told me. First of all, I hope that they'll feel that it's quite uplifting. First of all, it's a story of survival, ultimately. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to write it. And of triumph of these amazing women and their children. It does have the sort of happy ending of living of Hendon and suburban life and what this country stands for. And I think that's uplifting. And hopefully, I've also written it in a style I've inherited a little bit from my mother's way of telling the story. She was very keen not to do it to shock people. She was just trying to tell people what happened in a gentle way, and I've tried to do that.
And she, at various points, this comes across in the book, expresses surprise or asks, you the question, will people be interested in this, in
yeah,
this
she,
story?
She, honestly, the first time she did it, she gave a talk, which was at our synagogue. And I was, you know, to give you an idea of how long it was before people took proper interest in this, I was old enough for her to consult me for my opinion. I was in my late teens when she did it, started doing these talks, and it was at my synagogue. And she said to me, do you think people will be interested in knowing that I saw Anne Frank in Belsen? And I said, well, I think they will be, yeah. I mean, I had even sufficient journalistic ability and knowledge at that point to know that they would be. Yes, she often thought that people might not be that interested. And I had a very interesting note the other day from some friends of my parents who lived round the corner from us when we were young, lived across the road and then round the corner. And she said, I knew your mum for 40 years before I discovered that she'd been in Belsen. And I was completely horrified by it. And that's because just mum didn't, it wasn't that, she, if someone asked her, she'd definitely tell. And we did ask her. I knew all about it. She wasn't secretive about it, but she just didn't. She didn't want to be always the centre of attention and that sort of thing. And she thought maybe people wouldn't be that interested, which of course is ridiculous.
On the other side of the family, did your dad and his mother talk to you at any point about life on the collective farm? Or did it?
Oh, yeah.
But
no.
They're just describing it in detail. What did they find it difficult?
Lusha, or Granny, as I always called her. And Granny talked to me, was a great raconteur.
Yeah. Right?
She absolutely loved it. And I always remember we went to the lowlands of Scotland on holiday, and we used to get dropped off by the gate, which was about 20 to 30 minutes from the house, but walking. And we would walk back, and she would tell me stories of, you know, they were always stories of how the stupid bureaucrats had been defied by her sort of toughness and cheekiness. And actually, by the way, that turned out to be true. Mm. It's obvious from the correspondence I've got from her sisters based in London to her, from her sister and brother based in Leveuf rather, to her in the state collective farm, that they'd received reports elsewhere that she was a kind of leader in this collective farm. So they were true, these stories, and my father also says they were true, but they were always like quite charming. And one of the ones it's extraordinary actually in its own way, it's horrific, but it's also charming. My grandmother was so defiant, they never put her, would never put her in charge of anything on the state farm, because they knew that she wouldn't really do it properly. But one time somebody was ill, so she had to be in charge of the work group that went out to weed the crops. Well, my grandmother had absolutely no idea about it. She had a gardener, right? They were rich. She wouldn't have the first idea. But she didn't know what was a crop and what was a weed. So they arrive at the field, and She basically turns to the others, who have equally no idea what they're doing. Well, it stands to reason that there must be more crop than weed. So let's remove that of which there's less of. So they then go through the fields, obviously weeding the crop and removing the whole crop. And at the end of it, these weeds grow, and it's a disaster. They've destroyed several fields of crop. And the problem with that is that's sabotage, and sabotage attracts potentially even the death penalty, but certainly it's being sent to, you know, where they were on was a state collective farm, but could be worse, being sent to the Gulag. This does not happen. And the reason is that if my grandmother had been found guilty of sabotage, that would have meant that everyone was in on it. So not just the people on the work group, but also the woman who'd been ill and the supervisors of the farm, right? So the best thing was just not to say anything about it. So they, duly speaking, bag up all these weeds, and they take them, they put them in store for next year to use them as seeds for next year's crop. That is what I call the highest form of savoury agriculture, which is what these collective farms were supposed to be, because no one actually cared whether they produced anything on these farms, as long as they didn't get in trouble, because they didn't see any of the fruits of their fruits of their production.
The story imbibed since childhood has obviously formed, shaped you politically.
Absolutely. So I hope this is not a main purpose of doing it, but I hope friends of mine, you know, you included, who read it will understand my politics a little bit better. I am at the core of my politics, I believe that conspiracy theorist extremism, wild radical experimental ideas about reshaping society.
We've talked about it many times. You have a suspicion of big ideas.
Yeah, so I people will ask me, you know, where's the next big idea in politics? And I always go, well, you know, I quite like the small ideas because the big ideas, you know, they killed my family and spread them around the world and took all our property and, you know, all the things that I tell about in this book. I do have that feeling. I am for gentle progressive change within a fairly stable circumstances. I'm not rattled by someone describing that as boring or calling me bourgeois, which is, you know, which is a sort of ludicrous insult. And I think that book explains it. I guess it's true that it possibly inclines me to greater caution than is merited. So you read, for instance, the very interesting, I'm just reading them now, they take quite a while to read, Dominic Cummings' Startup Party Memos. And there's in it a sort of let's tear things up radical nature, which I think is entirely because his family's only knows, you know, the great stability that this country has offered someone like him. And he unfortunately takes it too cheaply, takes it for granted too much. In my view, despite the fact that he's a very interesting and challenging person. So, you know, I take his things seriously. So perhaps it can be accused of making me too complacent, but maybe, and too cautious. But maybe people reading this book will excuse me that.
Understood. Where are you politically at the moment? Are you feeling, and I don't mean in the narrow party political sense of the next election, we can talk about that endlessly another time. I mean, more broadly, how optimistic are you about politics globally?
I'm very worried, Ian, actually. Look, my view is that I had a very interesting discussion with my son about, who helped me with the book a lot, as I said, with Sam, about the question of how young people were turning against capitalism. And to some extent, even many of them against liberal democracy. Mm. And the way he put it was, you're always trying to give them an argument, Dad, and what they want is a house. And I think that's a really good, you know, obviously a stylized way of putting it. Because if capitalism doesn't work, people will find solutions that do work. And the disturbing thing is their commitment to a kind of stable capitalist liberal order, which we had assumed after the war because of the lessons we'd learned about how dangerous it would. People are forgetting those things now. We're a long time from them. People don't necessarily think it's that dangerous, and they look and think, you know, people will say, I would say it so often, you've probably heard this, everything in our country is broken. That's what they, and my book is like statement, I may as well put it on the front cover. No, it isn't. Right?
Yeah.
So here's what broken is. Okay, you read that book and you'll find out what broken means. And what we have is not broken, but it does require some progressive, intelligent reform. Okay. And I do worry about, and I worry all over Europe, actually less in Britain than in many places, but I do worry, you know, certainly worry in Poland and in Hungary and in other places, that Germany even, certainly France, the rise of these which is given rise to by national histories, temperaments, and also constitutions, mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons I'm quite resistant to a lot of constitutional change. Some of these extremist movements who are really quite dangerous in the kind of ideas that they're putting forward. And so I put it in the book, you know, I don't think the same thing that happened to my parents is going to happen to my children. But it could, I guess it could.
Why do you think Britain is an exception?
So I don't think it's entirely an exception. And there have certainly been things that worried me in Britain. I thought the decision to prorogue Parliament in order to drive through.
Yes, we disagreed region. About that at the time.
We did. Yeah, but I thought that was dangerous constitutionally. And I think there has been so Dominic Cummings, interestingly, he's looks at it straightforwardly. He says the problem in our country is too much reverence to institutions, and I don't agree with that. I think that institutional breaks to moods of change are very valuable.
Well, it's the biggest, speaking as someone who voted for Brexit, we were on different sides of that debate. It's one of the most interesting splits within the Brexit yeah. movement, and least focused on, because there are those of us who voted for Brexit primarily for parliamentary sovereignty.
But
there are a lot of Brexiteers who don't actually respect Parliament.
That's true. You know, you and I, despite the fact that we end up voting in different ways on this issue, we were actually pretty close. It's just we fell either side of the dividing line.
Yeah.
I'm worried about European Union utopianism. I think the project of trying to create a single European state is quite a dangerous one. So that I'm as concerned about that as I am about Brexit. Actually, maybe just marginally more concerned about Brexit because I ended up not voting for it. Mm. But I was concerned about that, and I was a Remainer in the end, and partly because I thought it was a wrench. And I think it was also bad for European, for the sort of unity of European states around a liberal democratic order. I thought it, so. I opposed it, and I opposed it pretty robustly and pretty firmly. But nevertheless, I was uncomfortable with the direction of the European Union in the 20 years before the referendum. For reasons that I think it was a big, untested, radical dreamers project, and I don't like those things. So I think that Britain is still vulnerable to all the things that other countries are vulnerable for. But as it happens, if you look at polls, for example, on the question of racism, you find that Britain, while there is strong entrenched problems of bigotry and of all sorts, is better than a lot of other places. For instance, I don't think there's anything wrong with British people being quite proud of that. It doesn't mean that we think Britain is perfect or that it's superior to other countries in every way, but it has certain qualities which I value greatly, and which make it unsurprising that it ended up being the place we were all comfortable to stay.
Well, we've wandered far and wide from this extraordinary book, but at the heart of it is Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Ian.